Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we celebrate the life and work of the late, great Lena Horne by presenting recordings Ms. Horne did with Pacifica Radio. Lena Horne was born on June 30th, 1917, and died on May 9th, 2010. We'll hear Lena herself talk about her youth and her early years at the Cotton Club and Cafe Society. But what's important to know about her for this hour is how it came to be that we have this extraordinary woman on tape in the archives. It has almost everything to do with her life as an activist and a champion of civil rights. Lena Horne's Hollywood career was essentially done by the mid-1950s due to blacklisting because of her political views. She was a close personal friend of fellow blacklisted superstar Paul Robeson and very active in the civil rights movement. It was here at Pacifica that Lena Horne, like Paul Robeson, found a home. In 1966, Pacifica station KPFA producer Gene D'Alessi sat down with one of the great talents of our time for an amazingly candid interview. Here's Gene introducing Lena Horne.
Pacifica Radio in Berkeley brings you Lena. Sound portrait of a multifaceted lady, Lena Horne. Concomitant with the publication of her autobiography by Doubleday, she talks for Pacifica listeners from San Francisco's Fairmont Hotel on Nob Hill. My name is Gene D'Alessi.
As your explanation of the phrase nitty-gritty.
I don't know. One thing I think it could mean is truth. One thing it could mean is the sediment that's left after something's been stirred up, and there, the nitty-gritty of it is left. It could be the bare bones of us, skeleton after the bomb. Not even a skeleton. That dust or that floating around, that's the nitty-gritty of us.
The nub of the matter, perhaps.
Yes.
That is,
lots of it's a good phrase. It covers a lot of territory.
You mentioned a phrase which I'm trying to locate in my notes, which I can't. But it was an equation between how people who live in poverty-stricken situations are best suited to become gourmets.
Exactly.
And when you mentioned that you liked chitlins, which Ralph Ellison calls chitterlings for some reason, I was amazed. Do you, in fact, really?
Do I really like them? Yes, I do. And I had them, of course, when I was a little girl in the South, and I also had them in the North when I was a little girl, and I had them when I was a grown woman in many places, and I had them in France. And I didn't know they weren't cooked the same way. They were, in fact, put into a beautiful sausage. And I kept biting it, and I said, what is this roulette, you know? It tastes so familiar. And I finally realized it was chitlins in Paris.
How much is 11 times 12?
Oh, I don't know. I can't count. What made you say that?
I was wondering about your
11 times 12.
Problem with the mathematics, which you mentioned, and whether it is...
You're tricky. You really did read the book, didn't you?
Everywhere.
I have a block about numbers. And I've wondered about that. It happened, of course, that my father was a gambler, and of course my mother said that that helped, among other things, break up their marriage. And I consequently was never able to do a card game, you know, beyond tonk, a kind of game you play backstage with musicians. And then my grandmother, who was an impoverished woman, suffragette, wonderful, really didn't think that money was... she didn't think that materialistic values put upon money was something that was as important as being treated with dignity as a human being. All the women in my family had a hang-up about numbers. I wish I didn't.
It's of no consequence, I suppose, at your station in life.
That's true. But I feel that money is so often made the value of something. And I was often told, well, we don't care really so much about whether you're extremely talented as how much business can you do. And that right away makes that block stay there all the more.
You mentioned the word numbers, and this is not a psychoanalytic interview, but yeah. It ties in quite well with your father.
Yes, it does.
Can you tell us about Pittsburgh and numbers?
Mm-hmm. My father was a number banker. He was in numbers. My father was a Negro man who to survive, hustled. And in the sense of hustling and a Negro man, it means that oftentimes if you were educated and able to get a job, the most menial, and that was all you had the opportunity to, the job you had to hold, you didn't want to do that. And you didn't want to work for someone who had less talent, less brains than you. So you risked your life. You laid your life down on the line. You were a hustler. You worked with, in many times, criminal attitudes. It took a lot of guts. And on the one hand, you chose that rather than have the man make a slave of you.
Who is the man?
I knew as soon as I said that I shouldn't have without explaining it. The man is the employer. And the man, who was usually the employer that offered the Negro man either the right to be a hustler or work for him, was usually a white man, a white employer.
And the spring-like day in 1966, that patois, the man,
yes,
continues.
Still continues, of course. The man is a sheriff in Mississippi. And the man is a cop in Harlem, white.
Could he be Negro?
He could be Negro, because even though he's Negro, the man who's the head of his police department is the white man.
You worked for the man at the Cotton Club in Harlem. The Cotton Club, as you describe it, was a garish former speakeasy which catered to the white community, although it was located on Lenox Avenue and 142nd Street, and in fact was a Jim Crow place.
In fact. On the one hand, I'm torn, and I was torn in writing the book, because that was the place that was the showcase for Negro talent, and one had to have some place to show one's creativity. Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, the great Ethel Waters. Negro people finally who worked under a roof in a cabaret that was a little better than a basement downstairs somewhere, and not a tent show in the South. But on the other hand, I was torn because it was a dreadful place with bad working conditions, little money, no respect paid to its creative people, and our own people couldn't come and see us perform. One didn't say too much about it because one then would get all the men fired who were waiters there, and one would get all the girls fired who took care of their families by working there. It was a trap.
A joint, as you call it.
A joint.
Or a toilet.
A toilet, yes. A plush line.
That's the vernacular. I think that's a show business expression.
That's a show business expression.
The interesting question at this point is, how did you get there? You were 16 mm-hmm. years of age. Mm-hmm. You appeared at the Cotton Club in the mm-hmm. chorus. Your formative years were difficult.
My mother was an actress. A truly dedicated, creative person who had no place to act. How dare she? You know, there were three theaters, one in Philadelphia, one in Washington, one in New York, where a Negro actress could act. Otherwise, she, you know, kicked around the South along with every other traveling gypsy, blues singers or otherwise, with no place to work. And I then came along and had to go to work. I had quit school. She was ill. And she knew some Negro people who knew people who worked in the Cotton Club, and there they took me there to be auditioned, and that's where I had to work. One had the choice in the old days. The choice wasn't very wide. You could be a whore or a cook, or you could struggle and be a teacher, and you could do few things. But on the whole, in an urban, in New York, a little corrupt, a little cynical, you were more apt to be a whore if you couldn't make it than if you were, you know, young, cute Negro kid, than be a teacher, especially if you hadn't had the education to be the teacher. And especially if your parents had no money to make you anything else. And mine had none, so I went into the theater.
Because the avenues led yes. about three directions.
That's right.
Noble Sissel and his society orchestra. Does that conjure memories?
Yes, it does. Noble had, I gather, had a very famous orchestra. He went over with the a very famous Negro regiment. First World War, he and a man named Jim Europe's orchestra it was, and when the war was over, they had been taken up by the Castles, Irene Vernon Castle, and so they toured all over Europe and played for dances, and Noble became the paternalistic Negro leader man in my life when I was 17 and a half, 18 years old. I went to work with his orchestra. We played for middle-class Negro people, white people, on the road and in towns. And he also taught me, or said to me, you must be a lady. Now, lady, I don't mean a lady who does no work and is an aristocrat because she has money and is waited on by people. I mean a lady so that you aren't any of the other stereotype Negro characters. And one must be neater and cleaner and more genteel in attitude so that one will be accepted for the sake of helping other Negro people. I was trained very early to be many things to many people.
There were many feelings of ambivalence in your life. You had what amounts to a puritanical kind of rearing.
Not for any of the right reasons, yeah.
And at the same time, you were hustling on stage, asking people rhetorically, do you want me?
Yes.
That's a phrase in your book. Now, these feelings of ambivalence, these feelings of being torn, the inner conflicts you had, resulted in a lot of hang-ups. There was an episode in Cincinnati.
There were two highlights about Cincinnati. One, poor Mr. Sissel was in an automobile accident. We had just gotten this good job, this rather good job. The orchestra was to appear at a place called Moonlight Gardens.
I know it.
And there had never been, you see, there was always that hang-up, first of all, of never been a Negro there before, you know, the hang-up of the, quote, first. So we knew it was important to have this job. And when he was ill, I had to go to the hospital, and he said to me, "You must front the band." And, well, now, mind you, here I was, you know. I used to just sit in front of the band and bounce around on the chair and get up and sing a chorus of a song. So here I was having to be the leader. If not, we'd lose the job. I said, "But one of the orchestra men can be the leader." He said, "No, here again, you see, you put a cute little kid up, a girl, you know, in front of, swinging around in front of the band, and you're the first Ina Ray Hutton of the Negro race, you know." In fact, I think one of the quotes in the paper said that. But anyway, all right, I did that to hold the job, and they didn't let Negro people in Moonlight Gardens, along with the fact that we were the first band, too. But also, opening night was the night of the Joe Louis Schmeling fight. And I had never, you know, thought too much about prize fights or anything like that. I had seen Joe Louis once in Harlem, and I knew, you know. And that night, the guys had the radio on backstage, and we were running off after each set listening, and my mother was over in the corner of the stage not paying too much attention, and of course, I don't know whether you remember that fight, but that night, I remember I was crying, and the men were kind of sullen and kind of not unhappy, but miserable and angry. And this terrible beating was happening, and I was crying and crying, and the mother suddenly saw me, and she said, "What are you crying for?" And I said, "But he's being beaten." And she said, "Well, you don't know this man. What are you crying for?" I said, "But I do. He's mine. He's ours." And that's the first time I had spoken like that to my mother. And I had never even voiced. I didn't know what I said. But my mother said, well, she shook me. She says, "What do you mean he's yours?" I said, "He's mine. And I don't want him to be beaten. He's ours." And I think that's the first time I remember ever identifying with another Negro in that way before. I was identifying with the symbol that we had of a powerful man, an impregnable fortress. And I didn't realize that we drew strength from these symbols. I don't think that they were meant to give us that strength by the man, but they did.
Just as Joe Louis was the symbolic manifestation of...
But he was a male, too.
Yes, but of the repressed wants of emasculated Negro manhood in a kind of a healthy vanquishment of Mr. Charlie, you have served as a symbol for Negro womanhood, or do you see yourself that way?
Well, you see, it was never clear-cut about a woman in anything, in this position. There you are with a sport, fighting. It's clean. It was a clean sport with Joe and so forth. It was the masculine strength in the body. The woman placed in the, for instance, my position, started with as a half-naked Corrine, stared at, going into more sleek and more glamorous supper clubs. And then, you know, oh boy, look at that. You never felt as pure an image as Joe's. That, and so you kept yourself, you know, and this, you kept this, you tried to keep this purity. Of course, cynicism clouded it all over, but you tried to keep this thing for yourself, and that's why I built this kind of facade in front of me, this hard shell, this thing, so that they couldn't get to the last thing I had left, my inner. I don't know why now purity embarrasses one to say purity, but do you know what I mean? I had to keep my inner purity.
What I was referring to in the last question was this. When you were, as you phrase it, pasted to pillars in movie scenes, you were unique because you broke barriers for other performers. Now, that time of your life is especially interesting, and the reason I mentioned you as a symbol, let me put it this way, is that you were representational of what the sophisticated NAA kind of Negro community wanted to purvey. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense, and that in truth is what they did want to convey. They, I was used, you know, by many organizations, first of all, to get employment for other people, but I was also used most uncomfortably for me to seem to appear to be a threat to the Negro people who had to accept any kind of caricature just to work.
Mantan Moreland.
Yes, or Step and Fetch It and so forth. All fine entertainers, but who were being what was said to be being Negro.
The stereotypical.
It's so funny. I often wonder what a director is going to say nowadays to someone on stage, act like a Negro. What is that going to keep meaning, you know? Because I find, even in my own family, hardly any of us act the same way, you know. So, but anyway, people there in Hollywood at that time, the Negro people particularly, who were in that kind of trap, had a right to resent me very much. And on the other hand, I certainly couldn't become a part of the Hollywood white group. I was never allowed to act really with another white person in a scene. I was pinned to the pillar so I could be cut out of the scene if it went to places in the South where it couldn't be shown. So I was really just sort of suspended in midair between the down on Central Avenue and out at MGM.
A rarefied atmosphere.
Yes. Mm.
31 years ago,
yes,
there was a man named Lewis Jones.
Yes.
Now, without revealing all of the details pursuant to your relationship with Mr. Jones, instead of the cruelest act of prejudice that you had encountered occurred during that relationship, can you give us a nitty-gritty summary of that?
I think you must mean the fact that I said the cruelest act of prejudice is what being a Negro man at that particular time, and in my our particular case, did to marriage. I said that the iniquities and the inequalities of being a Negro man out in the street working on his job and what he had to put up with made him, when he came home, a man that demanded prodigious strength. I don't know whether I'm pronouncing that word, but I mean it's almost like Atlas from a Negro woman, because she had to be the buffer and the healer of all those wounds he took outside. And sometimes the Negro woman got tired of being that buffer and being a wife and being tender and being loving and being and taking the beating that Mr. Charlie should have taken. And I think that's the cruelest thing. I was completely unequipped for it. And that was my first marriage, and I was a very bad wife because I had run to a marriage to get away from the earlier part of my life. Nobody, no, had no one, nothing. Hated this exposure of them looking at me this way. Run to him and come to him with no strength at all and wanted it from him. And he had none to give me. And I was a coward. I just crumbled beneath it.
From that marriage to Lewis Jones, and now you've been wed for some 19 years to Lenny Hayton, which was a cause celeb in itself, but I digress. That marriage to Lewis Jones resulted in a devastating experience, a devastating episode in the hospital, and you gave birth to your daughter, Gail.
Yeah.
But I guess we better not reveal the entire book. So let's skip to another facet of your life, Miss Horna, musically oriented one. Charlie Barnett, whom insiders a couple of decades ago called the Mad Mab, was part of your life. You know the origin of the Mad Mab sobriquet?
Well, in this day and age, Charlie would be called a blue-eyed soul brother. He happened to do a song or two that he called the Mad Mab. I don't know how it grew, what it came from. Charlie was a madman in all its fine sense. He was a brilliant musician. He was completely the kind of person that many musicians are. They care so much about their music that they really don't bother with stupid things. And Negro people liked him. And in fact, the big, and it still is, the accolade that one offered if the two white people, if one was a Negro, was to accept them at the Apollo Theater and to enjoy their work. And he had their respect as a musician. He gave me a job. He had given a job to Billie Holiday. I say Billie, and I think you know that. And Billy, you see, was not a tough woman. She was so vulnerable. She was an open wound. When I think and realize now how tough I was compared to Billy. And they killed her, you know. Anyway, she couldn't take it going at all on the road with the band. They were, because of Charlie, they were very understanding. They let me, I had to stay in New York and they'd pay me when I couldn't tour south with them. They would come out and sit in the bus with me on the road when we went places that didn't want me, a Negro girl, sitting up on the bandstand with those white men. And they commiserated when I wouldn't be served in a restaurant and they walked out, and, you know. And I had the strength, I think, to stay with him as long as I did, besides his being a great guy. I had had two babies and I needed to work. Billy, unfortunately, I only use her as an example of two of us in the same position. Billy had no children and no family. And so she was alone and had nothing to really help her hide from that kind of frustration.
There's a subterranean mystique about Billie Holiday. Mm-hmm. And there's an overt mystique about Humphrey Bogart currently. Bogey helped you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did.
I
when I came to Hollywood to work, I was going to open in the cabaret that never did get open, really. But when I did get a job in a cabaret. I had to get a place to live. The babies were there. And the management that I was working for rented this place in their name, and we moved in, you know, quickly. And I was already hung up and doing the job and everything and didn't remember to think like, every time you let your barrier down and don't think like a Negro, you get... You know, and I had just let my guard slip a minute. And the next thing I knew, there was a petition being gotten up for me to get thrown out of the place. And I didn't realize that right across the street from us, and behind this wall, I'd hear these noises and all, and parties and everything, and people fighting, and I didn't realize that it was Humphrey Bogart and May Umetho, whom he used to be married to. And I didn't realize he lived there until the friends came and said, well, said the petition got just about so far, but when they got to Bogart, I said, Bogart who? You know, they said, well, you know, they, and said, he said, get your petition out of my face, and if you harm her or do anything to her, I'll have you all killed. And that's the first time I realized, you know, and he absolutely threatened to punch them in the jaw, you know, and I didn't have any more problems. And he didn't know me, I don't think.